Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back to As It Is, the program that tells you about important events in our world and helps you learn American English at the same time. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. We begin today with information about recent news in the United States. There have been a number of incidents recently involving police and violence against citizens. In some cases, people have accused the police of using too much force when making arrests. Some have suggested that requiring all policemen and women to wear body cameras might better explain how they acted while doing their jobs. Others say it will force law officers to act properly if they know their actions are being recorded. Katie Weaver joins us to explain that the situation is really not that simple.
There are many questions about body camera systems, including costs, control of camera images, and the technology's limits. Charles McClelland is the chief of police in Houston, Texas. He supports the use of body cameras, but he admits they also present problems.
The type of equipment, the placement of the equipment, the downloading time, storage space, all of those are significant challenges.
For the past 2 years, the Houston Police Department has been using body cameras as part of an experimental program. The department deploys about 100 of the cameras on its officers each day. Chief McClellan says deploying cameras on a few thousand officers and then dealing with all the video they produce will cost a lot of money. And those videos can only show part of what happens when the officer is on duty. Body cameras usually offer a wide-angle view of what is in front of the camera lens. In other words, anything happening on either side of the camera or behind the officer is never recorded. Chief McClellan says that leaves out a lot.
An officer may turn his or her head and see something, but the video camera that's in the middle of their chest is pointing straight ahead.
Rita Watkins is the head of the Law Enforcement Management Institute of Texas. She says there is a statewide demand for body cameras.
I can tell you that right now there are chiefs who are budgeting within their budget and asking their community leadership for the funds to initiate and to start a body camera program.
She says legal experts are considering how photographs and videos taken by average citizens should be treated.
We've also got the public who's capturing video cameras. And so how do they maintain it? And what's their duty and responsibility for making that information available to law enforcement?
Both she and the police chief are concerned about what happens if a video becomes corrupted, is damaged, or disappears.
This technology is man-made, and sometimes man-made objects will malfunction.
Chief McClellan says a technical problem could fuel unrest in a city like Baltimore, where there already is distrust of the police. He worries that communication between officers and citizens may shrink because of the cameras.
The officer is recording the citizen. The citizen may be using his or her cell phone to record the officer.
Chief McClellan says body cameras can help law enforcement, but he says they also will become a continuing financial concern for police. He notes the cameras must be replaced over time by newer, better equipment. I'm Katie Weaver.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Since 2009, earthquake activity has greatly increased in the central and eastern United States. A new report from U.S. earthquake experts links drilling for oil and gas with the rise in the number of earthquakes in those areas. Jonathan Evans has more on the report and its findings.
It is widely known that certain parts of oil and gas drilling can lead to small earthquakes. The United States has expanded its oil and gas production in recent years. Critics blame the use of a drilling method known as hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, for the increase in earthquakes. Fracking involves forcing high-pressure water, sand, and chemicals into rock formations deep underground. The U.S. Geological Survey published a report on a study of 17 fracking areas within 8 states in the central and eastern parts of the U.S. Those states include Alabama, Arkansas, Colorado, Kansas, New Mexico, Ohio, Oklahoma, and Texas. Fracturing the underground rock releases oil and gas trapped inside. It also creates a large amount of wastewater. Roger Musson of the British Geological Survey says the problem is what to do with that water. Mr. Musson spoke to VOA by telephone. He says injecting wastewater into the ground to dispose of it is what causes earthquakes in the affected areas. It does this by loosening faults or divisions in the rocks that make up Earth's crust. Below the water table, there is water in the rocks, and if you change the pressure in that water, then it has the effect of lubricating the faults, he says. The USGS report says the new areas of earthquake activity are located near deep fluid injection wells or other industrial activities capable of inducing earthquakes. The most significant increase has occurred in the central U.S. state of Oklahoma. Before 2008, Oklahoma had just 1 or 2 earthquakes a year with a magnitude of 3.0 or greater. Now, Oklahoma has 1 or 2 such earthquakes every day. In a recent report, the state of Oklahoma said for the first time it is very likely that the rise in earthquakes has been caused by the disposal of wastewater from oil and gas drilling. Most of the so-called man-made earthquakes have been small and have done little damage. But experts warn there is no guarantee earthquake activity will not increase and cause more damage. This is being debated very urgently by seismologists, Roger Musson says. Currently, scientists believe that wastewater injection can produce earthquakes in the magnitude 4 or 5 range. But the upper limit is really very difficult to judge, Mr. Musson says. Environmental rights activists have criticized fracking. They say it pollutes groundwater and sends harmful gases into the atmosphere. Supporters of fracking say the innovative drilling process has helped grow the U.S. economy and has reduced American dependence on foreign oil. They add that the reports linking earthquakes to drilling activity are exaggerated. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. Consumers around the world benefit from large food stores and large-scale food production. They can buy many fruits and vegetables throughout the year that were once sold only a few months out of the year. But there is a price to pay for this year-round availability. The fruits and vegetables, like tomatoes and strawberries, often don't taste as good as they once did. Researchers throughout the United States are working to change that.
So all the onions and potatoes are out at room temperature, and this is warm.
Andrew Mace is a professional cook at a restaurant in Portland, Oregon.
Parsnips, leeks, turnips, first of the year asparagus.
Mr. Mace says he hopes the researchers can create fruits and vegetables that are easy to ship and store, but also taste good.
Something that's not compromised for storability or shape or disease resistance. It's all about the flavor, and it's a more pure flavor.
Across the United States, breeders, farmers, seed producers, and professional cooks are working together to create vegetables that have more flavor and more vitamins, too. Jim Myers is a plant breeder at Oregon State University. He says he does traditional breeding. He says there is enough genetic variation to work with. He tries to create fruits and vegetables that taste good, but also have resistance to disease, can be stored for a long time, and can be shipped without being damaged. Mr. Myers says the lab has created a program to connect breeders with chefs. He says developers are going back to their traditional roots as breeders to improve vegetables. Phil Simon is a vegetable breeder at the U.S. Agricultural Research Service. He has been working to create a better carrot for 35 years. He says the local food movement in North America and other places is responsible for the increased interest in the flavor of food. He says the more extensive local production of vegetables has caused buyers to seek better quality. He says local growers are seeking to provide more kinds of vegetables to meet the demand of buyers. Many countries restrict imports of seeds and plants. So some of the new fruit and vegetables with increased flavor and nutrition are only available in the places in which they have been developed. And that's the VOA Learning English Environment and Science Report. For more environment, science, and agriculture reports, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Marcia James.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal policies during the 1930s changed the face of American government. The new president and the Congress passed legislation that helped farmers, strengthened the banking system, and supplied jobs for millions of workers. One of the results of Roosevelt's policies was a stronger movement of organized labor in America. This week in our series, Sarah Long and Doug Johnson continue the story of the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal policies during the 1930s changed the face of American government. The new president and the Congress passed legislation that helped farmers, strengthened the banking system, and supplied jobs for millions of workers. One of the most important results of Roosevelt's policies was a stronger American labor movement.
Labor leaders had little success in organizing workers in the United States during the 1920s. Three Republican presidents and a national wave of conservatism prevented them from gaining many members or increasing their negotiating power. In 1929, organized labor fell even further with the beginning of the Great Economic Depression. By 1933, America's labor unions had less than 3 million members. But by the end of the 1930s, more than 10.5 million American workers belonged to unions.
New laws proposed by the Roosevelt administration made the labor growth possible. The National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933 gave labor leaders the right to organize and represent workers. The Supreme Court ruled that the law was illegal. But another law, the Wagner Labor Relations Act of 1935, helped labor unions to increase their power. Most of the leaders of America's traditional labor unions were slow to understand their new power. They were conservative men. They represented workers with certain skills, such as woodworkers or metal workers. They did little to organize workers with other kinds of skills. But a new group of labor leaders used the new laws to organize unions by industries, not by skills. They believed that workers would have much more power if they joined forces with other workers in the same factory to make common demands. These new leaders began to organize unions for the automobile industry, the steel industry, and other major industries.
The leader of the new movement was the head of the mine workers, John L. Lewis. Lewis was a powerful leader with a strong body and strong opinions. He had begun to work in the coal mines at the age of 12. Lewis rose to become a powerful and successful leader of the mine workers, but he was concerned about workers in other industries as well, and he believed that most of the leaders in the American Federation of Labor were doing little to help them. For this reason, Lewis and the heads of several other unions formed their own group to organize unions by industry, not by skills. They called their group the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, and they tried immediately to gain members.
The CIO successfully organized the workers in several major industries. but it succeeded only by hard work and struggle. The CIO's first big battle was against the giant automobile company General Motors. Late in 1935, workers at several General Motors factories began a sit-down strike at their machines to demand better pay and working conditions. After 45 days, General Motors surrendered. It recognized that the Automobile Workers Union had the right to represent GM workers, and it agreed to negotiate a new work agreement.
The struggle at the Ford Motor Company was more bitter. Ford Company guards beat union organizers and workers. But the Ford Company finally agreed to negotiate with the new union. The same story was true in the steel industry. But the new labor leaders succeeded in becoming the official representatives of steel workers throughout the country. By 1938, the CIO had won its battle to organize major industries. In later years, it would join with the more traditional American Federation of Labor to form the organization that remains the most important labor group in America today, the AFL-CIO.
President Roosevelt was not always an active supporter of organized labor, but neither was he a constant supporter of big business, like the three Republican presidents before him. In fact, Roosevelt spoke out often against the dangers of big business in a democracy. These speeches caused great concern among many of the traditional business and conservative leaders of the nation. And Roosevelt's increasingly progressive policies in 1935 made many richer Americans fear that the president was a socialist, a dictator, or a madman. Former President Herbert Hoover, for example, denounced Roosevelt's New Deal policies as an attack on the whole idea of individual freedoms. The family of business leader J.P. Morgan told visitors not to say Roosevelt's name in front of Morgan. They said it would make his blood pressure go up.
This conservative opposition to Roosevelt grew steadily throughout 1935 and 36. Many Americans were honestly worried that Roosevelt's expansion of government was the first step to dictatorship. They feared that Roosevelt and the Democrats were trying to gain power as the Nazis did in Germany, the fascists in Italy, or the communists in Russia.
The Republican Party held its presidential convention in the summer of 1936. The party delegates chose Alfred Landon to oppose Roosevelt for president. Mr. Landon was the governor of the farm state of Kansas. He was a successful oil producer with conservative business views. But he was open to some of the social reforms of Roosevelt's New Deal. Republicans hoped he would appeal to average Americans who supported mild reforms but feared Roosevelt's social policies. The Democrats nominated Roosevelt and Vice President John Garner to serve a second term.
The main issue in the presidential campaign of 1936 was Franklin Roosevelt himself. Roosevelt campaigned across the country like a man sure that he would win. He laughed with the cheering crowds and told them that the New Deal had helped improve their lives. In New York, Roosevelt made a major speech promising to continue the work of his administration if he was reelected.
Of course, we will continue to seek to improve working conditions for the workers of America. Of course, we will continue to work for cheaper electricity in the homes and on the farms of America. For better and cheaper transportation, for low interest rates, for sounder home financing, for better banking, for the regulation of security issues, for reciprocal trade among nations, and my friends, for all of these, we have only just begun to fight.
The Republican candidate, Alfred Landon, began his campaign by saying that many of Roosevelt's New Deal programs were good. But he said that a Republican administration could do them better and for less money. However, Landon's words became much stronger as the campaign continued. He attacked many of Roosevelt's programs. The campaign became increasingly bitter. Roosevelt said his opponents cared only about their money, not about other Americans. "I welcome their hatred," he said. Landon's supporters accused Roosevelt of destroying the nation's economic traditions and threatening democracy.
The nation had not seen such a fierce campaign in 40 years. But when it was over, the nation also saw a victory greater than any in its history. Franklin Roosevelt defeated Alfred Landon in the election of 1936 by one of the largest votes in the nation's history. Roosevelt won every state except Maine and Vermont. The huge election victory marked the high point of Roosevelt's popularity. In our next program, we will look at the many problems he faced in his second administration.
Our program was written by David Jarmel. The narrators were Sarah Long and Doug Johnson. You can find our series online with pictures, transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.